21-15-14, Vincent Moore versus Mike Brown, Warden. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Daly for the appellant.
Good morning.
Morning, Judge.
For the record, Craig Daly on behalf of Vincent Moore. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
Thank you. So what happens when the lawyer that you hire ends up being your enemy? Because he refuses to speak with you, refuses to conduct any investigation whatsoever. When there is a eyewitness who walked by the house in Detroit where this incident happened, and at the time he saw Mr. Moore leave the address in his house, and then shortly thereafter came back by the
problem is that eyewitness, though, didn't appear till 4 years after the trial.
Well, that gets to the issue of whether or not we can consider this as the habeas in terms of whether or not it's timely.
But isn't that, to go to Judge Gilman's point, it seems to me those go hand in hand, and unfortunately that's problematic for you because if you couldn't have found him through the exercise of due diligence, which makes your claim timely, it also sinks your ineffective claim, because if you couldn't have found him through due diligence, it's hard for us to say an attorney wasn't being diligent.
Well, let me respond in two respects. First of all, with regards to the timeliness of this witness, which is David Carbon, both the district court and the state concede that it's timely, so you don't have to deal with that. You can go directly to the IAC on the merits.
I totally understand that, but go back a step.
I will, and I'll address what you just said.
I want an answer, please.
Yes.
Which is, doesn't the fact that they're conceding it's timely because you couldn't discover the witness with due diligence? The very argument they're contesting with West Virginia and the family, they're conceding here, but that necessarily implies that the attorney could not have.
That's not necessarily correct. This witness was available during
I'm sorry to interrupt you. What's your best case for the proposition that it's both timely because it couldn't be discovered with due diligence and the attorney was deficient because he or she should have?
So what it appears that you're doing is you're just talking about one tolling provision, the statutory provision, which is that language could have discovered, right?
No, what's your best case? Just give me
When you say the best case, you know, we're talking about equitable tolling. The best case is Holland, the Supreme Court decision about how do you apply equitable tolling. But I really want to back up because I think you're making certain assumptions about whether or not the lawyer could have found this witness. This witness was in the area at the time that it happened. So if you're going to use that could have language of the statutory tolling provision, had he conducted any investigation, had he conducted, say, a canvas of the area, put out any information, he would have discovered this witness at that time.
So I just got a practical question, and then I'll let you continue, which is, why would he rehire this attorney that you say was his enemy? In other words, he has him.
Yeah.
He then has appellate counsel that's different. He then gets rid of his appellate counsel and rehires the person you say is his enemy.
Okay, so let's go back. The appellate lawyer was court-appointed. When they had Mr. Barnett in the original trial, they ran out of money, right? So his elderly parents are the ones who are funding this. So you have to understand what Mr. Barnett is doing. After the Court of Appeals decides that they're not going to reverse, right? Barnett calls the parents up and says, come to my office. And he tells them, I'm the only person who can get your son out of prison. And what he's doing is he's really protecting himself. He's not protecting Mr. Moore. What he's doing, because the attorney, a grievance commission, is investigating him right then, during that time, right? And there are two cases that I point out in 2013, one of which was my case, the Hunter and Terrell case, where they said that Mr. Barnett effectively committed perjury at the evidentiary hearings, and the Michigan Supreme Court says, we're going to reverse and send this back because Mr. Barnett didn't tell the truth. He has all that information. He knows that the issue raised by the court-appointed attorney is what? Ineffective assistance of counsel. So he doesn't want that to go to the Supreme Court, right? Given that the Attorney Grievance Commission is looking at him, the Supreme Court has already said at least two occasions that he's a liar, right? So what he does is he calls the family and he says, come in, I'm the only person that can get your son out of prison, number one. And number two, I'm going to go after the lawyer in the Court of Appeals who said that I was ineffective. So he takes the case, and he doesn't go to the Supreme Court on the issue of ineffective assistance. What does he do? He goes back to the trial court on a different issue, meaning there was deliberation without a juror. What he's doing is not in the interest of Mr. Moore. What he's doing is he's protecting himself from the Attorney Grievance Commission and the Michigan Supreme Court, who have both said, ultimately, that you're going to lose your license. And he did. His license was suspended in part for his professional misconduct in this case. So you have to see what this guy does. He's deceitful. He's manipulative. And when you have elderly parents that don't know any better and can't stand up to a lawyer like this, who's a blowhard, a big mouth, as he said himself, crazy, they get caught into that web of misrepresentation and deceit. So that's why they hired him again. They believe they got bamboozled once again by this lawyer who eventually loses his license.
All right, Mr. Daly, can we,
yes,
can we move on to the issues that we've certified with the for appeal, and the one that I have some trouble with is the testimony of the new witness, Carbon.
Yes.
That says that your client walked out of the drug house, and then several hours later, the gunshots were heard.
So correct.
There's a timeline there.
Yes.
Your client, though, isn't charged with physically committing the murder. He was charged with aiding and abetting the felony murder, which happened in connection with the armed robbery. There's a time gap here, which is troubling because it's contrary to the girlfriend's testimony. Because she appears
Farnsworth. Yes.
She appears to say it happened relatively soon thereafter. My question is, does it make any difference since he's charged with being an aider and abettor and he does not have to be there when the murder occurs? Does the discrepancy in the time frame make any difference, and if so, how?
I think in terms of the law, Judge Griffin, theoretically, when you think about aiding and abetting, you're correct. The defendant doesn't need to be there. But in this case, factually speaking, the testimony of Ms. Farnsworth was that Mr. Moore left the house shortly thereafter, came back with the perpetrators, the two men, and he was actively involved in the alleged robbery. He had a weapon, and she testified that he actually took the money from the deceased. So in terms of aiding and abetting in the time frame, we have to look at what this case is about factually, not necessarily legally, in the sense that the prosecution's theory was he was actively involved as an aider and abettor. He wasn't the shooter, but he came back into the house with those folks and left with the same people. And that's why Carbon's testimony is so important, because when he comes back and he's in that area, how many people leave the house? Two. What did Farnsworth say? She said all three of them left at the same time. And Carbon says, I knew who Vincent Moore was. And when I saw two people come out, it wasn't the defendant. That is exculpatory evidence that the jury never heard. The jury never heard any of that.
Right, right. So, you know, and I don't, but you're, the only issues here are ineffective assistance of counsel, right?
That's the bottom line on the merits.
Right. You don't have an actual innocence claim.
No, we're not claiming actual innocence, and the certificate was not granted on that grounds.
So, and that gets me back to what Judge Thapar was trying to get at. Well, if it's ineffective assistance and Carbon is clearly a key witness for you that cast doubt on the testimony of Farnsworth, well, but the fact is that that he wasn't discovered until 4 years after the trial, and due diligence wouldn't have uncovered his name at the time of trial. So how could Mr. Barnett be ineffective as far as not uncovering Mr. Carbon?
And I think the best answer, Judge Gilmore, go to the certificate, the order on the certificate, page 7. In that certificate, the court, this court, identifies how that works. So if we start in 2015, which is when Mr. Moore learned of the existence of some of these witnesses, including Mr. Carbon, that information then became available at that time. Now, and again, how does Mr. Carbon come to the attention of us in 2015? So the Moore family comes and hires me in May and the investigators, and when we start our investigation, within the same month, we have Mr. Carbon. It's the family of Mr. Moore who's doing the due diligence. They put out the Facebook recitation and say, do you know anything about this? That's how they find him. If Mr. Barnett had engaged in any effort whatsoever, because he's doing nothing, to find Mr. Carbon, and we're just talking about one category, because there's three categories here that we really need to address. Carbon is just one. We have the alibi witnesses, and then we have all the West Virginia witnesses that we haven't even got to at this point. But if we're just talking about Carbon, it's the family that's doing the due diligence. It's not the lawyer who was hired to do this. He did nothing when Carbon, when this happened, lived in the neighborhood. That's the difference. So back in 2015, he's left the neighborhood. He's out working on his own. He's more difficult to get hold of. But diligence on the part of the lawyer requires some, not none, investigation. So he was available back then. Barnett didn't do anything. He said, I don't want to hear about any witnesses. I don't want to hear about an alibi. I'm not going to do any investigation down in West Virginia for the witnesses who knew Ms. Farnsworth, that knew that she was an habitual liar, that knew that she was a drug addict, that knew that she lied on the witness stand about her relationship to the deceased, and most importantly, the subject of the robbery and the murder, the drugs and the money, she brings back to West Virginia. So to say that that's not important in this case and that the lawyer, you know, gets a free pass for not doing this, from the point that the family hired me in May and our investigators, from May to November, we had all of this information that you now have that Barnett could have had, but you know what his strategy was? Intimidate the jury. When you read the voir dire, he's trying to intimidate the jury, intimidate the judge, intimidate the prosecution witnesses, threatens to kill the prosecutor in this case. And so that's all egregious professional misconduct that falls within equitable tolling. And that's how we get to all of these witnesses for your consideration for ineffective assistance of counsel.
Okay. Any further questions, Judge Gilman? Judge Thapar? All right, you'll have your rebuttal, Mr. Daly.
Thank you.
Okay, let's hear from the warden.
Good morning, Your Honors. Morning. Eric Jenkins, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of the respondent in this case. Where I wanted to start with this case is actually where Judge Thapar started, which is the issue of timeliness really does create two issues here. Either the claims are untimely under AEDPA's 1 year of statute of limitations, in which case the district court was correct in not reviewing those claims, or if they are timely, it creates an issue for the first prong of Strickland on the merits of the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. The Carbon letter that's been talked about, if that could not be discovered until 2015 when Carbon came forward, it's very difficult to say that reasonable efforts on the part of trial counsel would have uncovered that evidence or that witness.
What about the West Virginia witnesses? Why wouldn't you, if you're Barnett, why aren't you investigating?
Yeah, and that's the problem with those witnesses is we don't know enough about how they were located now by counsel to say whether or not any reasonable efforts would have found those witnesses. They are witnesses that are out of state. The connections with players in this case seems a bit
right, tenuous. But Farnsworth's the key witness, so why wouldn't you investigate her at the very least and find out what people knew about her?
Well, and I hopefully this doesn't redirect the question, but I do think that there is an issue with the prejudice in terms of what these witnesses that were even located would do in terms of Farnsworth's testimony. Farnsworth was cross-examined for 2 full days by trial counsel, and when you look at the affidavits submitted by these West Virginia witnesses, essentially the testimony is that she had a reputation for lying and that she was a drug dealer. A review of the record shows that that was clearly demonstrated to the jury through cross-examination. So I don't mean to dodge the court's question on that, but I think we can move to the prejudice aspect of that, and there's no prejudice from these witnesses not being located and introduced at trial. The cross-examination of Farnsworth, actually the direct testimony itself, established that she was a liar. She admitted to being convicted of obstruction of justice in a previous case, to lying to a police officer. She admitted, I can't remember if it's on cross or direct, I think it was on both, to be honest, she admitted that she lied to police during this investigation to protect herself because she was up there buying pills. So she lied about the reason she was coming up there, and this was to the police during the investigation after her boyfriend was murdered. She lied to Crystal Breck about why they were coming up to Michigan. She told her it was coming to buy a truck. She mentioned nothing about going up to buy pills or anything like that. So I think it's clearly documented through the cross-examination that she was a liar. The Farnsworth witnesses, the affidavits from West Virginia, would have done nothing to add to that. And in fact, a lot of what the affidavits contain are based upon hearsay, conjecture, and speculation. I think the reputation for dishonesty is about the best you can get from those witnesses, and even that's already been discussed quite extensively through the direct and cross-examination. And the fact that she was a drug dealer was also brought up on both direct.
Did she also contradict herself as to the time frame of when the murder occurred?
I believe she did. I believe there's a lot of estimation. I think during cross there was some confusion as to what trial counsel was asking in terms of timelines, but my recollection is that she was pretty consistent on when it happened. She may have changed whether or not she saw specifically Mr. Moore grab the money from the deceased. I think she said at one point she saw him with the bag, and it was mistakenly believed, I think on direct, that she saw him actually grab the bag from the victim's body, but later on she relented and said, no, I just saw him with the bag afterward because I didn't look down at the time.
Okay. I mean, if we get past the time frame, the timing of the eyewitness who shows up later, tell me why that testimony would not be important, why it would not have an impact.
Yeah, I think, Judge Griffin, you asked Pallant that question, too, of what difference does it make.
Yeah.
I think it makes no difference, to be honest.
Tell me why.
First of all, there's 2 points that come out of that witness's testimony. One, he saw Mr. Moore leave the house where the murder occurred at 9 a.m. on the day of the murder. That's consistent with the state's theory. At both witnesses, Crystal Breck and Ms. Farnsworth, testified that around 9:30 a.m. on the morning of the murder, they were meeting with Mr. Moore at a Burger King in Detroit. So him leaving the house at 9 a.m. has no bearing on the state's timeline. In fact, it makes sense that he left that somewhere at 9 a.m. because he was going to meet with them at 9:30 a.m. The second point that comes out of that testimony is that he saw 2 men who were not the defendant exiting the house after hearing gunshots. There were several other witnesses in the neighborhood. They were neighbors across the street who testified to that exact same thing at trial. Both of them said they saw 2 men leave the house. One had a long gun in his hand, the other one didn't, and their descriptions of those 2 people were not consistent with Mr. Moore. So that witness offers nothing new than what was already presented to the jury during the trial.
I thought he said it wasn't Mr. Moore, whereas the other 2 were vague. The husband and wife or couple or whatever it was.
Yes, they may have been vague, but I do think there's a difference there that matters, which is that if they had said we saw Mr. Moore, whereas this witness is saying, I did not see Mr. Moore, that would be one thing. But that's not what's being said here. They were vague about it, but they were, the descriptions they gave, and I think it was, the point was made by trial counsel.
Maybe I'm wrong, but there seems like a difference between those two, we can't describe them, versus I saw them and Moore wasn't one of them.
There is a difference. I will agree on that point, but I don't think it's a difference that matters such that it undermines confidence in the outcome of this case, because the descriptions they gave were pretty clearly not Mr. Moore. I think trial counsel made that point during his opening statement, that the people they described were not Mr. Moore. Carbon just can say, well, I know Mr. Moore, I know that's not him. There's not such a difference there that you're worried about this undermining confidence in the outcome. I think another key point about the Carbon letter is that he's not sitting there babysitting the house throughout the day. He has no knowledge of what happened between 9 a.m. and when he heard the gunshots. He has no idea if Mr. Moore came back to the house. He has no idea if Mr. Moore came back to the house with Ferguson, Farnsworth, and Breck. All he can say is that at 9 a.m. I saw him leave, which again is consistent with the state's timeline. And then later on he says, I heard gunshots from the house, and then I saw two people who were not Mr. Moore leaving.
And more than that, though, he said, but and Moore's car, though, was not there when he came back.
That's correct. Although
a jury, I guess the whole point is a jury could draw an inference from that, that, hey, Moore was not there at the time of the murder.
They could also discredit the testimony or discard that testimony, because we don't know where Mr. Moore's car was parked at the time. There's no testimony saying his car was out front versus it was in the back or wherever. I understand there is that, you could look at that evidence and see that, but I don't also think it forecloses the fact that Mr. Moore could have gone out a different part of the house. He could have.
I'm just saying that the whole premise, though, of the district, I'm reading from the district court, the jury could find that Moore took the money from Ferguson's pocket after he had been shot. Well, that's what the state court basically did too. But if Moore was not there, based on Carbon's testimony, the jury could say, hey, we believe Carbon and don't believe that he was even there. So in other words, he clearly participated in aiding and abetting a drug deal. The question is, did he really aid and abet a robbery?
That's correct. And I think that there's two points out of what the question you've just asked. One is exactly that. It's the charge here is that he aided and abetted the robbery. So he doesn't necessarily have to be there at the time. But I also think the carbon letter does not foreclose that he was there at that time. He just did not see him run out the front of the house with the other two men. It doesn't foreclose that he went out a different door, his car was parked somewhere else. So I think that part of this this letter is somewhat weak in terms of the evidentiary value that it would have.
I mean, there might be a legit actual innocence claim, but of course, that's not what's before us, right? It's only an ineffective assistance of counsel. That's the defense's main problem. If they couldn't have reasonably found Mr. Carbon at the time of before trial, it's hard to say he's ineffective.
I do think it matters that Carbon is not in the house when this happens. He doesn't see what's going on inside the house. All he can say is that he saw two men who were not Mr. Moore come out the front of the house at that time. And again, I don't think that is so over-the-top actual innocence that it forecloses the fact that Mr. Moore could have been there at that time and gone out a different way or gone and gotten to a car, or his car would have been parked somewhere else at that time. And if the court has no other questions, I would rest the rest of my argument on our briefs. Again, I think that two of the claims are not timely here, and if they are timely, that forecloses the issue of whether or not reasonable counsel could have located those witnesses. As to the Carbon affidavit, and then as to the other two, Carbon letter, and as to the other two pieces of evidence, I do think that, as we argue in our brief, if you got down to the bottom line of this, there's no prejudice that's being established. For both the reasons I've said on the record today and for the reasons outlined in our brief. I would thank the court for its time.
Any further questions? Judge Gilman? Judge Thapar? All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
All right. Rebuttal, Mr. Daly?
Thank you. So even though it seems like the questions have been focused on Carbon, we're really talking about three categories of witnesses. We're talking about Mr. Carbon, we're talking about the alibi and affirmative defense that wasn't presented, and the West Virginia witnesses. So the big difference when we're talking about the bottom line, which is this a verdict that is fair and reliable? The answer is no, and that's why we're entitled to habeas, because there was no affirmative evidence. There's a huge difference between the cross-examination of a witness by the lawyer and having affirmative evidence. He wasn't there because he was with his parents and his brother working on a car. The witness, Farmsworth,
See, it doesn't really matter if he was there. I know that's the prosecution's theory, that he was there. But the evidence, in my mind, would be sufficient to satisfy a conviction for aiding and abetting if he sets up the armed robbery. He sets up the drug deal, which leads to the murder, which is the basis for the felony murder conviction, that he does not have to be there. And don't you agree with me, as a matter of sufficiency of evidence?
Not on the evidence, theoretically.
No, I mean, the jury can infer from the circumstances that he was part of this the scheme or plan, and that he aided and abetted it. I mean,
you're talking, that's the difference between theoretically being correct and factually. So if he leaves hours before, to the extent that you're arguing that, he could have set this up correct.
It's a reasonable inference for the jury to make, is it not? That he took them to the drug house knowing that they're going to be robbed and that murder is certainly a possibility. The felony murder comes from the robbery. It's a connection of a murder in connection with the robbery, which is the felony murder. But isn't that a reasonable inference that a jury could make?
I think a jury could make that inference. But what you're doing, Judge Griffin, is you're taking the theoretical and separating it from the factual. The factual is he was there and he did this. You can't ignore that. The jury can't just say, well, at some time before that, he did all these things. The inference becomes much more removed, much less reasonable. If he's gone hours before, as Carbon said, and he doesn't come back. Because the evidence was he was there and an active participant. The aiding and abetting was he didn't pull the trigger. That's the key part. Because he was there, he had a weapon, and he allegedly took the money.
You know, you have a bank robbery situation where you've got somebody that's got the getaway car.
Yes.
And he doesn't go into the bank. He doesn't rob the bank. He doesn't pull the gun on the person. In fact, he's just waiting there in a car. And the police come in and they arrest everybody in the bank, and the guy in the getaway car says, well, I wasn't there. I didn't do anything. But he's still an aider and abetter, is he not?
He may be an aider and abetter, but again, it's not theoretical, right? To be an aider and abetter, and under Michigan law, you can be present, right? Mm-hmm. Even though, have knowledge of what's going to happen, but you're not responsible unless you have the intent of the people that were involved.
Sure, and that's a jury question. Isn't that for the trier of fact?
Yes, but here we're talking about a jury that never had any of that information. He wasn't there. He was with his family. The main witness, Ms. Farmsworth, is a liar well beyond cross-examination. People who knew her. Can you imagine being in a jury box and listening to witnesses that actually knew the prosecution's witness and says, don't believe a word she says, as opposed to just cross-examination from a lawyer who admits that he's crazy and he's acting crazy and he's trying to intimidate the witness? Those are totally different things. That is not a reliable verdict. Are there any other questions?
Anything further? All right. Thank you, Mr. Daly.
Thank you.
Appreciate your arguments. Case will be submitted. You may call the next case.